This is London.
I'm exploring the sounds of a hidden history. Black music was the soundtrack to Europe during the Second World War.
You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister.
This country is at war with Germany.
Condemned by the Nazis, jazz became a symbol of protest.
This is the BBC Home and Forces program.
The German army invaded Holland and Belgium early this morning by land and by landings from parachutes.
The map was torn up and normal life put on hold. As Europe fell, black music thrived underground.
When the war started in 1939 and Germany occupied all its neighbors left and right, jazz flourished in those countries as well, and that can be proven by the many, many recordings that were made during that time.
I'm Clark Peters, and today we're listening to black music in Europe during World War II. Many of the rare recordings of this era have been tracked down by the German record collector and historian Rainer Lotz.
Mind your step. We are going down to the basement. Now, we are now in the basement where I keep all my records, because my wife wouldn't tolerate them upstairs, and at any rate, there isn't enough space upstairs. But here in the basement, I can spread out. Here we are. Yeah.
This record is Honeysuckle Rose by the Hot Club of Frankfurt, a group of German jazz fans who made music in secret at the height of the Second World War.
The label is hand-drawn, very cleverly done, multicolor. They had, of course, no access to record pressing facilities, so all this was done clandestinely. They recorded on a portable direct cut machine. And this is the 12th record of the series, dating from 1941. Those people had clandestine jam sessions, mostly in private homes. If they were caught doing this, they would probably first be beaten up, then their long hairs would be shaved, and then they would be re-educated in concentration camps. But nothing happened to those people because they weren't caught. I prepared a reissue of all the surviving records. Poor sound quality, poor musical quality, but that's beside the point. The point is that this was going on in defiance of the authorities, and the artifacts have survived. People all over Europe had special hairdos, special tailored suits, special way of walking and playing music, and all that was in defiance of, you know, the goose step and short haircuts of the military type of people. In France, they were called the Zazous. In Germany, they were known as the Swingheinis or something like that. And they were closely watched by the authorities. Many were put to jail or into concentration camps, but they would still do clandestine jam sessions, etc. They would meet in private.
It wasn't just in Germany that music fans operated in secret. Occupied Paris was also a center of underground jazz. Here's Julia Brown, an expert on the history of Black Paris.
We're in the Saint-Germain-des-Prés area. It's the 6th district of Paris, right in the center, just south of the Seine River. And this is where the jazz center set up. Nightlife for the occupying forces here in Paris in the early 1940s. It looked like one thing, but in fact it was something else. What it looked like on the surface was that the Nazis had outlawed the playing of jazz here in France, so you couldn't really hear it. It wasn't supposed to be played anywhere. But on the other hand, if you dug a little deeper, you would find that those jazz clubs that had been so popular in the 1930s in the Montmartre district had found a way to rebel against the occupying forces, the Nazis. They brought their music, their love of music, and their playing of music down here, where we're standing now, in the Saint-Germain-des-Prés and the Latin Quarter, because in this area here, there were underground cellars, and those underground cellars were soundproof, so they could get away with playing jazz music, so that's what they did. The atmosphere in these crowded, smoky, tight little cellars was exactly that. It was a place where jazz lovers came together and they played all around this area. So they created little spaces, and that's where the tradition of the underground cellars, les caves of jazz, were played in this area here.
At the center of Parisian jazz was guitarist Django Reinhardt. Despite his gypsy roots, Django was tolerated by the Nazis and was allowed to continue playing throughout the war. This song, Nuages, became an anthem for the French resistance. It was released on the Swing label, a haven for many black musicians in Paris.
Black people did not leave Paris. Charles Delaunay started his own jazz record label, the first record label really devoted to jazz and only to jazz, the Swing label. His recording activities proved that he employed black musicians all the time through the German occupation. They were Frenchmen, most of them, and others were people of German descent, Afro-Germans who lived in Paris and continued to live there and make recordings. So that's amazing. And that history still has to be written.
Here's just one of those black musicians, African-American trumpeter Harry Cooper. Recorded in Paris in January 1943, for Charles Delaunay's Swing label. This is Blues 43. While black musicians were under attack in mainland Europe, it was a very different story in Britain. This is Snake Hips Swing by the West Indian Dance Band, an all-black jazz group that played to huge acclaim across the UK in the late 30s and early 40s. They were fronted by Ken Snake Hips Johnson, a dancer and band leader from British Guyana. Here he is in 1940, speaking with writer and activist Una Marzen, the first black woman broadcaster at the BBC.
When I got over here, I got a band together, nearly all Jamaicans. We were billed as the Jamaican Emperors of Jazz, and we got stage engagements at various cinemas in the country. And then after a year, I reorganized the band with West Indians from all the important islands in the West Indies, a real West Indian band.
And this new venture led you where?
Well, again, we were very lucky. We got a contract to play at the smart West End club, the Florida. We stayed there for 2 years, and made some very good contacts.
And so then you really felt established.
I'm glad to say we did. The following year, we played another fine West End nightclub, Willoughby's. And for the last year, we have been playing continuously at the Café de Paris.
Up and up the ladder. That's certainly progress. Tell me, Ken, what would you say was the secret of your successes?
Now you're asking me a rather difficult question. Now let me see. I myself am all for swing music, and I have a fine lot of musicians, young fellows, who don't merely play for pay, but who enjoy every minute of their work. Their enthusiasm is infectious and has stamped the style of the band.
Ken Johnson was my godfather. He was a dancer and cast himself as a sort of Cab Calloway, a great front man.
Singer Elaine Del Mar is the daughter of Leslie Jiver Hutchinson, a trumpet player from Jamaica who played with Ken Johnson's West Indian dance band.
I love this one. This is the band taken the back by the dustbins outside somewhere, but they look so smart, don't they? They look stunning. It was taken for the Melody Maker. My father is there. There's Joe Denise. The guys have all got beautiful white tuxes with carnations, and they're taken against a brick wall. But of course, above that, you can see the dustbins. But they look stunning. I was born in 39, so the war had already started. You'd walk up and go to school, and then when you'd hear the sirens going off, you'd run back to get home before the sirens stopped, because that meant trouble. There was going to be a bombing, you see.
Home before the siren is the motto these days, and people are streaming into the tubes and the buses, and the roads are filling up with cars from 3 o'clock onwards.
It was quite a tight community, because there weren't many black faces, and they hung in there together. Always music in the house. Guys popping in to rehearse. They would have been sort of slightly mimicking what was going on in the States, you know, with the Cab Calloways and the Ellington. And that's what the guys listened to in the Caribbean. They were listening to that music, and that was the way they wanted to play. So they came here, and there were nightclubs, speakeasies, the Panama Club, little jazz clubs. There was always a gig going on. London buzzed.
Throughout the 1930s, the black presence in London, and certainly in the musical circles, you get a very real sense of that growing quite rapidly.
Professor Catherine Tackley is head of music at Liverpool University.
So, obviously, black Britons who were musically skilled, like the Denise brothers, coming to London, but also, and I think this is really important, West Indian musicians coming to London specifically to be musicians, to come because there was a demand for West Indian music and for black musicians on the London scene. West Indian people in Britain were not always subject to the same sort of rules of conscription, and this did seem to give the West Indian Dance Orchestra an opportunity to come much more into the mainstream. Another, I guess, really significant thing with the war is that the band at that point achieved this residency at the Café de Paris, which is still standing, is still a venue. The Café de Paris was always considered to be a very safe venue because the majority of it, you go straight down underground. So, and it actually advertised itself as such as well. It had a particular focus on black performers, all sorts of acts, you know, black, British and African American. But obviously to have, therefore, an all-black dance band in residence at that venue made a huge amount of sense.
I can see practically the whole of London spread round me, the whole of the skyline to the south lit up with a ruddy glow. The flames are leaping up in the air now. The dome of St. Paul's Cathedral is silhouetted blackly against it. It's almost like the Day of Judgment.
The Blitz began to hit London in September 1940, and the West Indian dance band would never be the same again. Here's their guitarist, Joe Denise, remembering the band's final concert.
There's one night I'll always remember, although I don't dwell on it, is March the 8th, 1941, Saturday night. And the time was about 20 minutes to 10, because we started about 9:30. We went on at 9:30 and played for about an hour or so for dancing, and then the cabaret would come on. We were sitting there playing away, and we started to play Old Johnny. And the next thing that happened, there was a god-awful thud. Everything went, all the lights went out, plaster and stuff boiling down, people yelling. I thought, I just couldn't visualize it. Why should it happen? we're underground. But apparently what did happen was the bombs, there was a stick of bombs starting off from Leicester Square, went right across Leicester Square to the Café de Paris into Coventry Street and further up towards Dean Street. Next thing I know, I was put in a sort of one of these noddy type ambulances, not a fully fledged one, like a sort of a small van which had been converted to for emergency use. Taken to Charing Cross, laid out in the entrance hall there with God knows how many other people. It's very vague. And I'm trying to quite remember who came to me and said, Joe, he said, Ken's dead. It broke me up, yeah. Ken's been killed.
At least 34 people lost their lives that night at the Café de Paris, and many more were injured. Britain's first black jazz big band was no more, and its remaining members went their separate ways.
Those surviving musicians were very rapidly absorbed into other dance bands, you know, predominantly white dance bands in the capital. So I don't think it's too much of a leap to say that almost overnight, you then have a very high number of racially integrated bands in Britain in a way that you just did not have before the war. In all likelihood, it would have happened in time anyway, but it was the sort of suddenness of that within the circumstances of war was quite remarkable.
Another star of the London club scene at the time was Nigerian composer and organist, Fela Shawande. Here's singer Adelaide Hall speaking about Fela in 1993.
Before the war, we took over the Florida Club, you see, off of Bond Street. And Fela Shawande was my pianist, my accompanist. Fela Shawande was always properly dressed in his white tie, you see, and his evening clothes. Always perfect, which made it so lovely. And that was the place that had the revolving floor. That was the only club, I think, in the West End that had a revolving floor. Because we used to have some of the ladies-in-waiting from the palace to come after their due, if it wasn't too late, and they come for a night supper. They would dance on this revolving floor, and it would look so beautiful in the beautiful white dresses that they wore, you know. Everyone had a white dress, and it was so pretty.
As well as his jazz work, Shawande was also an acclaimed composer of classical music. He is perhaps best known for this piece, African Suite, composed in London in 1944.
I would describe Fela Shawande as the father figure of Nigerian classical music.
Juan Ogumbe is a musician and choir leader and a longtime admirer of Fela Shawande's work.
He was born in 1905, died in 1987. He lived in the UK from the 1930s through to the late 1950s, and in that time created a body of work that has stood as a template for many Nigerian and other African composers ever since.
You're tuned to the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
This is Fela Shawande speaking to you from London. I feel very pleased to have this chance of discussing our native music with you, and perhaps to suggest the possibilities of its development.
In 1940, Fela Shawande made some recordings for the BBC, and they were about his vision for the development of African art music.
There is almost unlimited scope for the development of our native music. We need not be ashamed of the fact that in order to do this, we shall have to borrow what we need from European music. The different European races had to borrow from one another before they came to the high standard that they enjoy today. The matter of using European music is in itself of very little importance. What is important is that we should not let ourselves lose the real African character of our tunes, whatever we do to them in the way of developing them.
He was articulating his hopes for what composers could do, what they could make of the material they have already from African music. In African Suite, in the last movement, he takes a melody that's a very popular kind of folk tune that's almost like High Life. Oni dodo, oni moi moi. Oni dodo, oni moi moi. He takes that and he develops it into almost like some kind of, I guess, fugue in a way. At that point in time, there was the idea of drawing from folk music, as could be heard in the music of Bartok, Vaughan Williams, or even maybe Dvorak, you know. So I believe Fela Shoande did a similar thing, aiming to use folk music as his source material for creating more kind of elaborate pieces. He set an example for everyone. It is possible to create the work and to have a distinctively African-sounding art music.
I am looking forward to coming back home after this war. In the meantime, we can set our minds to work on thinking out plans, which we may put into effect when we come back to a normal and improved life. Till then, God bless you all. This is Fela Shoande signing off from London.
Germany calling.
While Fela Shoande was broadcasting on the BBC in London, German radio was sending out a very different message.
Hello, Churchill. I think you started something. Now listen to Charlie giving you the work.
You started something. Yes, you did, and you thought it very easy to declare a charming war and beat the Nazis, you fool.
In spite of the official suppression of jazz music, the German Ministry of Propaganda and Public Enlightenment used a jazz band to broadcast towards the United Kingdom and the United States.
Music historian and record collector Rainer Lotz helped unearth this story. It's the bizarre tale of Charlie and his orchestra, who recorded over 250 propaganda songs for the Nazis.
Here is the latest song of the British Airmen. Let's go bombing, oh, let's go bombing, just like good old British Airmen do.
The trick was to play modern dance music and jazz music. And then they would, in Germany, turn the lyrics into propaganda lyrics. Anti-British, anti-Jewish, anti-American later on.
Here is Churchill's latest appeal to Roosevelt. Frankie, Frankie, the Germans are driving me nuts.
That band included one person of Jewish descent and one people who had African descent. So they weren't all that strict about that if it served their own purposes.
Here's their drummer, Freddie Brockseeper, speaking in an archive interview from 1987.
They said, we want the best jazz musician in Germany, in Belgium, from Belgium, from Holland, from Italy, and so on. We got a mixed band, you know, and they took all the best jazz musicians together in one orchestra. My father, his mother was physicist, so I was a quarter, you know. And better I do that and make my good music and make money before I take a gun and I have to shot against the other.
Yes, the Germans are driving me crazy. I thought I had brains, but they shattered my plans.
I always wondered why, in all that secrecy, they would have license imprints on the record labels. like Francis Day and Hunter, for instance, which was a London music publisher. And I later found out that because they sent those records to radio stations in neutral countries, those radio stations would have to pay license fees, royalties. So the German government, through Switzerland, paid royalties to the publishers in London during the war. So they recorded anti-British propaganda records, but paid royalties for that records to the publisher located in London.
Thank you very much, Charlie. Thank you again. That was Charlie and his little cabaret of 15 minutes of fun and song. And we'll be back on the air, as always, every Wednesday and Saturday, won't we, Charlie?
Yes, sir.
From propaganda hits to clandestine sessions to black British swing, jazz was the soundtrack to the Second World War. It even made an appearance on D-Day.
This is the BBC Home Service. D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress.
Fellow I met, he was involved in jazz. He was in the infantry and he was going to land in France on D-Day, 6th of June 1944.
Writer and historian Jeff Green.
And he was stuck out on the great air bases of Norfolk. Many of those air bases were American. And the Americans had gramophone records. They were flexible, they wouldn't break. You know, Ella Fitzgerald and Count Basie and Benny Goodman and all the stuff which the British guys had sometimes got on record. And this chap decided that as the French wouldn't have had any jazz records since 1940 when they were invaded, he emptied his knapsack of spare clothes, ammunition, hand grenades, and you name it, and filled it up with jazz records, which the Americans had given him. And I said, well, what would have happened if your knapsack had been hit or something? He said, well, I could always pick up more clothes somewhere, he said. And, he landed on Normandy Beach with a backpack for jazz records.
The paratroops are landing. They're landing all around me as I speak. They've come in from the sea, and they're fluttering down, red, white, and blue parachutes fluttering down. They're showering in. There's no other word for it.
Next week, we turn to the sounds of black Europe in the aftermath of World War II. From high-life nightclubs in the heart of Soho.
People didn't realize how much rhythm there could be in music. It was fresh and lively.
To the great Sidney Bechet, live on stage in Paris.
The French people loved it, you know, and I think that made him so happy, his happiness translated on his play.